So as we heard during the reading from Isaiah, that Jesus is the light of the world, that the people in darkness have seen a great light, kind of looking ahead to the moment of the Messiah. Sometimes you will hear Jesus talked about in the sense that he is the light of the world. And actually, as the story plays out from the reading in Luke, that after Jesus is born, about a little over a week later, his parents, Mary and Joseph, take him to the temple. And there's a kind of a mysterious prophet-like figure whose name is Simeon, whom we don't really know who he was, although we have some ideas, and I'm not going to get into it. Ask me some other time. But he scoops Jesus up and says, among other things, he will be a light to the nations. In other words, we're very used to thinking, nice job, we're used to thinking of Jesus as the light of the world in some sense. But what does that mean? What does it mean to say that Jesus is the light of the world? I mean, as best I can tell, we don't mean that he is emitting photons or something like that. So that presents something that we need to figure out or explain. And I'm willing to bet I'm not the only one who hasn't actually sat back and thought, wait, what are we actually saying when we say that Jesus is a light? Now, the Hebrew prophets and the tradition of the Hebrew prophets is a tradition of being really masters of language. Another prophet, Habakkuk, actually will say, again, looking ahead to the time when that is ushered in by the Messiah, the Holy One, that that the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. And we might say, oh, okay, that's nice, it will just be everywhere. Except isn't the sea the waters and the waters the sea? What does he mean by that? And it's easy for us to just kind of skip that over without taking some time and thinking, praying, and meditating on what's actually being said. So what does it mean? What do we mean when we say that Jesus is a light in some sense, that the people in darkness have seen a great light, that he is a light to the nations? To get at that, I'm gonna take a really hard turn left. Trust me or don't, I'm going somewhere with this. It's going to be a little strange. About 30 years ago, a group of engineers got together to address a problem that was starting to become apparent. Because by that point in time, like rechargeable batteries were starting to get actually useful. And there were these like really weird devices that were becoming more accessible. And it was just, it's even strange to think about. Like, you could take your phone from home anywhere. Can you imagine that? How weird is that? You could go anywhere as long as there was a cell tower nearby, which, as I vaguely recall, was kind of an art form in and of itself. But it wasn't just that. Other things like laptops were actually becoming useful and portable. Other devices kind of in that same vein were starting to be more accessible to the general population. And so this group of engineers started addressing this problem of how do you get all of these very different kinds of devices to talk, to communicate. Which, if you don't know, and if this is not your thing, no worries, that is a very, very significant challenge. Now this project was given a very weird code name. It was named after an old Danish king who lived about 1,000 years ago. His name was Haraldr Blotlund, son of Glorm, or Glormson, just in case that clears things up. And he was given, they used his name for this project because Haraldr, King Haraldr or whatever, was known for two things. The first one wasn't it, but he was actually a Christian convert. But the second was that he managed to unite the Scandinavian tribes for the first time. And as the engineers were kind of codenaming this, they thought, well, we're trying to unite all of these devices. Now, the intention was always that this that codename, because who wants to name something after Haraldr Blotlon Glormson? You can forgive me if I forgot that last part. They just figured at some point they would kick it over to the marketing and ad people, and they would come up with a neat name. And they had some other ideas of what to call it. But for various complicated reasons, the name actually stuck. The problem is that I don't speak old Danish. Maybe you do. And so instead of just using his actual name, they used his English translation of his name, which is Bluetooth. Now, the point of this story is not that fairly interesting bit of tech history, but actually your reaction to it. There were about three people here that I saw go way before the punchline, and then a whole bunch of you after that go, oh, and I want you to think really hard about the way you might have responded to that. Because Bluetooth technology is absolutely everywhere at this point. I'm willing to bet everybody here over the age of 15 has a Bluetooth-capable device in your pockets. If you drove here in any sufficiently new car, it has Bluetooth. We have it in our thermostats, our printers, of course our computers, and every other imaginable thing that might seem like it shouldn't, but whatever. It is something that is ubiquitous, and it has been in front of you this whole time. In fact, its symbol, which I'm imagining most of you can picture, that like weird-looking angular bee, that's actually just the rune that is Bluetooth's initial, like Blotlon Bluetooth, the actual guy. What I find fascinating about that is that it has been in front of us this whole time. Basically everybody here used it, and now suddenly you know something a little bit more about it. You can see something about it that you haven't seen before. Except for like the three or four of you who seem to know where I was going. Now, there are many ways that we can describe that moment of recognition. But the one that I want particularly to hone in on is that you might say that the lights went on in your mind. You have that moment of understanding, that moment of, oh, as if it was a switch that was flipped. And it's undergirded by the fact that it has been in front of you this whole time. Now let's think about the light going on in that sense, and Jesus being a light to us. Say it's like 2:30 in the morning, and you had to get up for something, and you knock something off of your nightstand or something like that. Don't raise your hands, but how many of you spend far too long on your hands and knees searching for it before you think, maybe I should actually just turn on a light? And then you turn it on. Now, you don't turn on the light to then stare at the light. You turn on the light so you can see what is in front of you in a different way. When Jesus hits the scene, the point is not that suddenly it's just this beam of bright light that we all stare at. But rather the point is that first and foremost, this Jesus whose birth we celebrate tonight will show us something that has been in front of us this whole time. In fact, he's going to show us a whole bunch of things. That once you see it, you might find yourself saying, how could I have not seen this my entire life? That was the initial just shocking reaction to what Jesus said and did. Now, there's a couple of other interesting parts of the story worth thinking about. Because Jesus is born, there's a bit in the temple, and then he vanishes for 30 years with like one very small exception. Think about how that might resonate with you. Because if the light of the world has been born and then vanishes for 30 years, what was God doing? We don't really know. But I resonate with that. Because how many times have I been sitting just in the middle of life being the mess that it is, thinking, where's God? Where are we going? What is happening here? I don't understand. I can't see and understand in any appreciable way what is happening in front of me and around me. Because as it turns out, those moments when we feel like God is silent or God is absent or the lights have gone off and God is just dark for a period of time is a universal experience. And as hard as those times can be, I don't know about you, but those have been some of the times where I've grown and matured the most. There's sometimes, and I'm not going to say whether it always is or not, because I have no idea. I am not God, if that's not clear. Is that maybe sometimes God is just quiet. And those periods of time are very intentional. Now, that said, Jesus is born, he grows up, he is the light of the world. What is that light going to do? Because the point is never really to look at a light. Like our world, Earth, has a light source, the sun. I think we all know you don't look at the sun unless you want to have a really bad time after. But it's because of the sun that you can see. To quote C.S. Lewis. So what light does Jesus shine? What is he showing us that we haven't been able to see previously or might be difficult to see? Now, Jesus did many things. We're just going to touch on one or two. One of them being that he showed immense compassion and generosity and mercy to the wrong people. To those who are on the margins of society, sometimes just by their own actions. Or maybe to put it another way, Jesus showed immense compassion and mercy to those who are difficult to love. I'm willing to bet that everybody here can think of somebody who is hard to love. And if you find yourself thinking, well, no, actually, I can't think of anybody that's hard to love, I have bad news because that person might actually be you. but then if we think about it, and just by nature of my career, I've known a lot of people on a pretty deep level. Even the easiest people to love can sometimes be pretty hard to love. We are those people. And Jesus has this strange audacity to show compassion and just genuine love and mercy to the wrong people. And by doing so, he shines a light that many might have known but did not understand. That it turns out these human beings, in all of our wild complexity, have a certain kind of inherent dignity, value, and worth. One of the hallmarks of the early Christian movement, as it just contrasted with the broader Greco-Roman world of its time, was that these strange groups of Christians actually cared about people not in their immediate circle, people that they were not related to and did not have a kind of business relationship with. Like, they were the first people to do that, as strange and crazy as that sounds. And as it turns out, that has a rippling impact that really by, 250 or so years after Jesus, about half of the population of the empire was Christian, because it turns out once you see it, you can't unsee it, but you cannot see it without a light. Now, to push this further, Jesus, among, again, the other things that he does, is that he will teach. And he teaches within a first century Jewish context, which seeks to understand God's teaching, or Torah, sometimes called his law, as it relates to everyday life. I'll let you decide if it's an actual problem. The problem, or the tricky thing, is that when Jesus teaches, he doesn't always make things easier. Sometimes he does, but not always. For example, in the law, there's one in particular that says don't murder. And first off, I would commend this law to everyone here. Not murdering is, I think, the right thing. But the problem is that I guess I can only speak for myself. I have never murdered anybody. Because I am that pious. And Jesus will even say, you've heard it said, don't murder. But if you harbor anger or hatred in your heart towards someone, it's the same thing. You have to spend like 10 minutes driving in Albuquerque and you will have committed murder in your heart. That's how that works. In other words, as he's doing this, and he does this in a bunch of places, and it's in some sense maddening, but it eventually gets to the point where it's freeing. But first it has to disrupt you. Because Jesus takes the problem, or moves the problem from just general behavior, and he moves it to our own hearts. That human beings, in their wild, beautiful complexity, as really in many ways the crown of creation, in spite of all of that, something has gone wrong. Whatever your posture, attitude, belief, ideas, whatever, towards Jesus, I don't know a single person who will not say that some things have gone really, really wrong around them. And what Jesus has the audacity to do is shine a light on our hearts and reveal that the problem actually is me. I mean, there are lots of problems outside of me, for sure. But if I'm willing to be really honest and allow that light to shine into my heart, I will see that at least within my area of control and influence, the problem is actually here. This is a universal human experience. And actually, if we fail to see that, really, really scary things can happen. If we define evil, badness, whatever words you want to use, as the things out there, those people, those other people, that group, whatever, anything that does not include me, then we will become absolutely blind to the evil that's actually within us. And we will fail to address the problem in some of its deepest level. To put in another sort of obnoxious way, if we were all perfect, there are so many problems we would never experience. And as Jesus goes around and reveals our own hearts to ourselves, in other words, shining a light on our own hearts, you might imagine some people find immense freedom in that truth, and plenty of others get really irritated. And you go around doing that enough, they will kill you. And that's exactly what happens. And in some ways, that's kind of the obvious trajectory for Jesus' life. I mean, yeah, this is Christmas. We're supposed to be talking about the birth of Jesus, but that's just where things begin. We would not be celebrating Christmas if Jesus' life didn't end the way it did, because when it ended in his death, his life was restored. He was raised from the dead. And as we come to realize over time, his death wasn't just a singular event. Like in our baptism, we are buried with Jesus. We die with Jesus. And then we are raised in new life. A resurrection life. To put it another way, we are given a new heart that is full of new life. We become part of this ongoing, complicated, and occasionally frustrating, and sometimes terrifying movement we call the church, that is of course filled with problems because people are at the center of it, and yet we also believe that this Jesus who welcomed and loved the people who at the time especially were considered unlovable, recognizing that we belong in that same group, and suddenly our hearts start to transform and change. We become more aware of the darkness within. And on the one hand, we recognize that that darkness is a real problem. And on the other hand, we realize that not just through Jesus' death, not just through his resurrection, but just his life in general creates this space where rather than fighting it and trying to convince ourselves that we are not the problem, that we are in fact okay, which is a very, very difficult thing to try to convince you of because our hearts being what they are, that what Jesus actually creates is space to say, yeah, that's true. That's true about me. And rather than despair, that brings freedom. Because even if that's true, in Jesus' death, in his defeat of death, it doesn't matter anymore. God's compassion, mercy, grace, and forgiveness are completely total and overwhelming. Where the darkness within does not change the love that God has for all of us. Now, again, this is Christmas. So we're supposed to be talking about Jesus' birth, and that's all well and good. I like Christmas, but Christmas is meaningless without Easter. Christmas is just the beginning. It's the light slowly being turned on. It's the candle being lit. It's the modern world. So it's the LEDs, starting up or powering on. I don't know, use whatever metaphors you want. It's the Bluetooth devices connecting. There we go. I didn't think about that first service. I wish I had thought of that. But the point being is that Jesus also does not tell us anything that is foreign. All he's doing is shining a light so that we can see what's been in front of us the whole time. Now I'll end with this. Think about the stories, like movies, books, stories, whatever that are really, really satisfying that employ that storytelling technique. These are like the heist movies, like Ocean's 11, the whodunits, like Sherlock Holmes, or other like really, really intricately well-told stories that have this kind of mysterious tension going until, boom, the point is revealed, you get the punchline, and you realize that the details were all available to you, the entire movie, the entire book, the entire story. Those are uniquely difficult, but amazingly satisfying stories to hear or read or movies to watch. Why? Because it's not telling you something you didn't know. It's showing you what the reality is to begin with. I think there's a reason why we resonate with stories like this. It's because it echoes the human experience. So Christmas, for all of the many things it is at least just the beginning of God showing us our reality. And then entering into that reality with us and for us. And confronting the human condition in the many different ways he encounters it. Brings about its death and gives us a new heart when death itself is defeated. And tonight we get to celebrate just the beginning. Merry Christmas. Please rise as you are able.